Okay, it is March 7th, 2022. This is Jen Brown. I'm here with Dr. Mike Wetz at the Heart Research Institute, and we're here today to do an oral history about his life and work with plankton ecology, water quality, and as well as his work with Baffin Bay. For the record, do I have your permission to record?
Yes, you do.
Okay, thanks. So let's start. Can you tell me more about your background and early life?
Sure. Well, I grew up in southeastern Ohio in a little town of about 600 people. Actually, it's a village, not a town. very rural community. But from an early age, I started getting really interested in sharks. And I think it's because my brother made me watch Jaws when I was like 4 years old. And I don't know if that scarred me or what, but I was always reading books about sharks and going to the library and... So then, you know, our family vacation spot was Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. So every year I'd, you know, try and either go visit the aquarium or, you know, go fishing with my dad. And, but yeah, I was just always interested in the ocean from an early age.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about sharks and the ocean really drew you to?
I don't know. I just thought it was, I don't know what it was about them really. The fact that they could eat you if they wanted, I thought that was interesting, and so I was always interested in, okay, what sharks are out there, and, you know, what sharks might be harmful, and, you know, what do we know about sharks? It just, all of that kind of interested me.
Did you ever come across any sharks on these trips?
When we went fishing, we did. We'd occasionally catch them and not know what to do with them. I mean, we were just, you know, a bunch of hillbillies from Ohio and had no idea, but... Yeah, that was about the extent of it.
Okay, so. Yeah. So your family, what did they do?
My dad worked at a coal-burning power plant in Waterford, Ohio. And then my mom, she just worked various jobs and also raised me and my brother.
Okay, so. How old's your brother?
Oh, he's 13 years older than me.
Okay.
So my parents, they don't hesitate to tell me I was an accident. I mean... I was. So here I am anyway.
Okay. Yeah. And did they help foster your interest in sharks in the ocean?
Yeah. My mom especially took me to the library quite a bit to get books on sharks, and then took me to SeaWorld. They took me to SeaWorld quite a bit in near Cleveland, Ohio. So that was probably the best opportunities I had for that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That kind of covers your interest in marine science.
Yeah.
So did you know that you wanted to go to college and study the ocean? And...
I did. I was one of the, I think, rare people that just, like, ever since I was a little kid, I kind of knew what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And so then I went to college at Coastal Carolina University, and I majored in marine science there.
Mm-hmm. And from there, obviously, you went and got your PhD. Did you know you wanted to get your PhD? What drew you to... graduate school?
Yeah, I was very fortunate to have had a couple of internships starting in my sophomore year at Coastal. Oh, so are we all good?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
I just,
sorry. Yeah.
I'm a little paranoid about it.
Yeah. So I had a couple of internships. I worked. The first one I had was at the aquarium in Myrtle Beach. And so I didn't at that time know that I wanted to do my PhD and go into research. So I tried a couple of things. I worked at the aquarium, and then I also had an internship in a research lab at the University of South Carolina with a fellow who was studying harmful algal blooms. And I quickly realized I hated working in the aquarium because it really wasn't about just, you know, working with the animals. You were constantly fixing pipes and doing all kind of random stuff that I didn't find interesting. But I really enjoyed working with the scientists at South Carolina on harmful algal bloom issues, because it was something that, you know, really connected back to us from a human health standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I kind of settled on what I wanted to do with the rest of my life, I guess.
Yeah. So then what did you do?
Well, I worked for him for almost 3 years. I developed my own independent project, and I was actually fortunate that he let me run with some ideas, and I was able to publish some papers as an undergrad, which was pretty cool.
Really?
Yeah, and it was also very fortuitous. I was supposed to start graduate school at Oregon State in the fall of 2000, and I had a project that was still underway that I wanted to see to completion. So I deferred my enrollment until March of 2001, and in the meantime, my wife took a job at the lab I was working at in South Carolina, and that during the fall of 2000. So, you know, if I'd started grad school, I never would have met her.
Oh.
Yeah.
How did you two meet? Just in the lab?
Just in the lab. It was a really small lab. Okay. So I'm like, hey, a new person, you know, let's go have dinner or something. So.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Great. So she moved with you out to Oregon?
Yeah. So she moved out there about a year after I did. So we kind of did the distance thing for a while, and then she found a job and came out there.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about your experience in graduate school.
Oh, it was awesome. I went to Oregon State University in their oceanography program, and I did a lot of work with plankton and, you know, looking at plankton and carbon cycling and, you know, plankton, what causes plankton blooms off the Oregon coast. So I went to sea a lot. I spent about 100 days at sea. And I think I enjoyed it for the most part, but, you know, there was one cruise where we had 35, 40-foot seas easily and for about 2 days straight, and that kind of made me realize, I think I want to go work in the estuary again. So yeah, but it was a really beautiful place, lots of interesting things happening out there. That, you know, the Oregon and California coast, it's really on the sort of front lines of climate impacts on marine systems. They're really seeing a lot of changes. It's just changed incredibly over the past 20 years since I've been there, you know, since I was there. So it's a really amazing place to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, Corvallis is not, I mean, is there a separate Oregon State, like, lab on the... Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, they had at that time, it was a fairly small lab in Newport. And, of course, since I graduated, they've been getting all this crazy funding, and NOAA moved there. So now Newport is just this amazing, burgeoning place on the Oregon coast, and they built their lab up. So I missed out on all that, but... I still enjoyed, most of my time I spent in Corvallis, and then I would go to sea out of Newport.
Mm-hmm. So. And what did you write your dissertation on?
It was basically looking at how carbon gets cycled when you get the big diatom blooms off the Oregon coast. So diatoms are a type of phytoplankton. They're very iconic. You know, most early oceanographers, they studied diatoms as sort of the base of the food web. And Oregon gets these huge blooms off the coast every year. So I was looking at where does the carbon go when these blooms happen. And so that's what it boiled down to.
Where does the carbon go?
Well, what we found is that, you know, when the blooms are developing, most of the carbon stays locked up in the cells. But then as the blooms start to sort of hit their senescent phase, meaning they're stopping their growth, there's a good bit of that carbon that kind of gets released back into the environment and gets chewed up by little bacteria and things.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, our view of marine food webs changed a lot. We used to just focus only on the carbon that was trapped in the cells. But then we started to realize, hey, there's all this other carbon that's going back into the environment. And really... sort of just a different view of how the food web works.
And how does climate change and those changes you talked about on the coast play into that?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the most striking examples, I think, is they've been having these, what they call the Great Pacific warm blobs, I guess you call them, these big patches of really warm water that develop off the Northeast Pacific there. I think 2015 was a really bad year, but it's been happening more and more. And what that does is it kind of prevents this oceanographic process called upwelling. It prevents that from happening. So upwelling is where when the winds blow in a certain direction, it allows the the water to move in a way that brings up deep water to the surface. And it's this cold, really nutrient-rich water that fuels the food web. But with this warm blob of water, it just kind of caps the ocean off, and so you get less primary production, so less of the plankton there. It also tends to favor these plankton that are not good for the environment, so harmful algae blooms. And it's just not been a great thing for the ecosystem out there. They have issues with the fishery. It causes problems for the whales that, you know, rely on these plankton blooms. Just a lot of changes happening out there that to me it's really striking that it's just happening so quickly.
Interesting.
So yeah, you know, a lot of people refer to that whole area from California to Washington as sort of a canary in the coal mine for a lot of the, you know, climate impacts that we might expect.
Mm-hmm. So how did you shift from studying the Pacific Northwest to the southern coast?
So when I was in South Carolina, I worked in the estuary quite a bit. So it always kind of had a, you know, there was always a fond place in my heart for estuaries just because they're, you know, they're right at that interface between where we've got a lot of, you know, urbanization and built infrastructure and then these really critical habitats on the water. So there's just a lot of things happening in the estuaries. And so I was fortunate. I connected with this really famous estuarine ecologist. He does a lot of water quality and harmful algal bloom issues in North Carolina. And I ended up doing a postdoc with him in Morehead City, North Carolina, at the University of North Carolina's Institute of Marine Sciences. And so that just kind of drew me back into the South and into working in estuaries again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And where did you go from there?
So I spent 2 years as a postdoc, and then I took a faculty position at Florida State University in their Department of Oceanography. Started there in December of 2008, and then all three of us new hires got our pink slips in May of 2009.
Oh.
So yeah, it was really a weird time. So that was right in the middle of the quote-unquote Great Recession. But, you know, FSU had just hired a whole bunch of us, and then, you know, they had these, I guess you could say, perceived budget issues affecting the university. But what we learned sort of after the fact is that there were a lot of politics. Apparently the provost at that time really had it out for the oceanography program, and so used the budget issues as a way of really hammering the department. So got laid off. They kept me on for a year with the stimulus funds that came out. But in the meantime, I was fortunate to land the position here, because it was a pretty bleak job market at that point.
Yeah.
But it was a struggle, you know. We had just bought a house thinking we'd be there for a while, and just found out we were having our second child, and then to get a pink slip in the mail, that was pretty brutal.
How did you deal with that?
I don't know. I didn't handle it too well, but we got through it. I think I probably shed a few tears at some point, you know, just, but it, I mean, it happens. It's rare, but it happens. But yeah, had a great family network, you know, great support network of family and friends, and we got through it,
mm-hmm.
found a job, moved on. So I mean, it is what it is. So
yeah. So you got the, when did you start here then?
I started here in, August of 2010. So let's see, I got my layoff notice in June of 2008, somewhere around in there, and stayed on for a year I'm trying to get my timeline. I try to forget that whole time period. Maybe they kept me on for a year and a half or something like that with stimulus funds, but another colleague, Brian Arbick, he went to the University of Michigan. I came here, and we both kind of left at about the same time, so they must have kept us on for you know, over a year mm-hmm. with stimulus funds.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I try and put the FSU experience out of my mind as much as possible.
I don't blame you. That's yeah. pretty crazy.
Yeah.
But you got the job here.
Got
so.
The job here, and it was really nice. So I came here right when TAMUCC and the College of Science and Engineering, they were really trying to ramp up their research. And so I think I was actually the first hire to actually get some startup funds to build a lab. And so it was also just a really great experience because it was unique in the sense that I was able to speak with the dean, Frank Pezold, a lot just about, hey, you know, where should we go from here and how can we do this and just share ideas. He was just a really welcoming person and really trying to, you know, grow the research enterprise here. And so it was just it was an amazing experience. I don't think if I'd gone anywhere else that I'd had that level of access and, you know, ability to offer input on what we should do.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And when you came here, did you know what you wanted to study? How did your scientific background change?
Yeah, I didn't really know. I had an idea, but it was in 2012 when some of the Baffin issues started popping up, and so I kind of redirected my focus to start to address some of those issues. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, we were doing some work with students in Oso Bay, just because it's really accessible and it also has some water quality challenges. But Baffin really kind of took us in a new direction.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me more about some of the more interesting and important things that you've discovered about Texas bays and estuaries?
Yeah. You know, I used to think that there was this straightforward relationship between the fresh water coming in, which delivers nutrients, and then presumably plankton blooms and the productivity of the estuaries. But I think what we've come to realize is that that's not necessarily the case. And part of it is these systems are just so shallow that even when you don't have a lot of fresh water going into them, they can still stay productive because of nutrients and other fuel for the plankton that kind of builds up in the sediment and then gets released back into the water. So I think they're very resilient ecosystems. And, you know, I know that fresh water is a big concern and the amount of fresh water going into them. And it's certainly important, but from a primary productivity standpoint, it seems like these systems can kind of adapt to dealing with not having as much fresh water coming in at times.
And what's the role between fresh water inflow for water quality?
Mm-hmm. Well, it can be good or bad. So what the fresh water inflow does is it creates the salinity gradient that is really good for a lot of estuarine organisms. It also brings in the nutrients that fuel the base of the food web, the primary producers, your plankton. But it can also be bad, especially if the quality of the water coming in is not good. And that's one of the things we're seeing in Baffin Bay, which is that, and you know, you can talk to some of these folks that and they'll tell you that, you know, it used to be that when you got a good rain event, you get all this clean water coming into the bay and it would kind of flush it out and act as sort of a reset on the bay, and it was great. Now, you know, the quality of the water coming into the bay is not good, so it actually causes a lot of negative things to happen in the bay. So the fresh water is great, but it has to have good quality as well.
And what happens when it's not of good quality? What does it do to the bay?
Oh, all kinds of things. It can trigger, you know, persistent high levels of algae in the water. It can cause the types of algae to change to less healthy algae. It can cause low dissolved oxygen events in the water. When you get a lot of algae in the water, that can also decrease the amount of light that goes to the bottom. And so in places where you have lots of seagrass beds, they need light. So if you've got poor quality water and lots of algae, they don't get the light they need and then they die.
Is that what happened in Baffin Bay with the brown tides? Is that why the seagrass died?
Yeah, there was documented losses of seagrass, both in Baffin and the Laguna Madre from the brown tides.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hmm. So the water quality is sort of that, you know, other part of the story. Mm-hmm. There's the quantity side, but also you have to have good quality water.
Yeah. How do scientists define water, good quality water?
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on who you ask. So a lot of the state agencies will have standards, so basically levels that they set for different indicators of water quality. And so if you exceed that level for a certain amount of time, et cetera, then they consider the water to either be impaired or, you know, have some kind of level of concern. And generally those levels are based on some either prior studies basically it's based on other evidence linking those levels to some harmful impact on the environment. And that's what it boils down to.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay. Do you define water quality the same way in your lab?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. So it's a little complicated in the state because, you know, so the big water quality issue we work on are nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus, and then the algae blooms. A lot of states are developing real hard standards for each bay system for nutrients. Texas does not have nutrient standards so far, so there's still a lot of wiggle room in there in terms of how we define good or bad water quality, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm. Have you observed or studied any kind of changing water quality trends in Texas?
Yeah, we're actually fortunate in that the TCEQ maintains a long-term monitoring program, and they have data on a lot of different water quality indicators from every bay system. So we have a really nice long-term data set. And we've been doing a lot of work over the past 5 years to mine that data and look at trends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What sort of trends are you seeing?
Big picture, the thing that amazes me most is that despite all the population growth we've had on the coast and other changes, our water quality is generally in pretty good shape on the Texas coast. We do have some bad spots, I guess you could say, like Baffin Bay. That's certainly one of them. And you know, there's other areas where there are some problems. But you know, I'm kind of surprised we're actually in pretty good shape for now. We want to keep it that way. We don't want to become the Floridas of the world. Our state agencies, and in particular the General Land Office, they're really trying to stay on top of this, being proactive and developing, you know, approaches to facilitate the growth on the coast, but also trying to alleviate negative impacts on the water quality.
Mm-hmm. What else do you want to talk about kind of in general outside of your work in Baffin Bay?
Give me an example. What are you thinking?
Well, I'm not sure.
Okay. I don't know. I'm pretty excited about, you know, a lot of our a lot of our initiatives right now that we're trying to get off the ground are really trying to get ahead of the curve, so to speak, kind of going back to that issue of, you know, okay, so we're in pretty good shape now, let's keep it that way, let's not become Florida. And so, you know, to do that, we're trying to do things like developing a harmful algal bloom monitoring network, which, you know, in our field, monitoring, people are kind of like, oh, monitoring, more monitoring. But what we're trying to do is get data in real time so that we can get warnings out there to the public and to resource management agencies so we can prevent any, you know, real harmful impacts to people and potentially the environment, you know, before they happen. Again, we don't want to be the Floridas of the world. We don't want to get caught, you know, flat-footed dealing with these issues. So that's one of the initiatives we're really trying to get out there. And then also we've been working on this report card initiative, which basically we're taking a whole bunch of different data, so on water quality, on fisheries, on oysters, habitat, and even socioeconomic conditions. And we're trying to pull all this together to give a really comprehensive assessment of the health of each of our bays and of the Texas coast as a whole. And what that does is it will help us to really say, okay, where do we need to focus our efforts over the next X number of years in terms of, you know, either restoration or conservation efforts. And it also gives us sort of a baseline as the coast continues to change, so we can see, okay, where are those areas that might become problematic in the future. And what's really exciting about that is it's involved a lot of stakeholder engagement. So I've gotten to meet a lot of people up and down the coast, and so it's been really fun. And it kind of circles back to my experience with Baffin Bay, which is, you know, when I moved to Texas, I didn't really know what to experience or what I would experience in terms of, you know, conservation interests and things like that. But, you know, through both Baffin Bay and the report card, it's just amazing to me how many people care about, you know, the bays and the coast, and how many people are willing to step up and do something about it. I mean, I've never lived anywhere where it's been like that. The report card's been really fun. Stimulating intellectually, but it's just been fun to get to know a lot of people on the Texas coast.
Mm-hmm. So, can you talk about your move over to HRI and what that's meant for your work?
Yeah, you know, I love my time in the college, and of course I'm still a faculty member in life sciences. The main difference is I don't teach as much, but what that does is it allows me to spend a lot more time with the stakeholder engagement and outreach side of things. And so it's really allowed me to kind of dig in and get some of these initiatives off the ground, and I think it's hopefully been very beneficial to the university, but also the community.
Mm-hmm. So what year did you start over here?
2018.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So I had about a good year before COVID hit.
Brutal.
So yeah.
Well, maybe just, do you want to expand on that, of kind of the role of the pandemic and what it did to your work?
Sure. So from a practical standpoint, I mean, we still got out every month on the water and did our sampling. So we didn't really miss a beat there. I have a great team of you know, lab crew who just made things happen. And, we couldn't have made the progress without them. So that from that standpoint, we were fine. But what the pandemic did is it kind of hurt our ability to get out in the public and hold meetings and, you know, really bring solutions to bear on some of the issues we're working on. And so now I'm seeing that as the pandemic hopefully starts to wind down, you know, we're able to get back out there, and there's just this pent-up interest in getting things done. And just over the past month, we've had some pretty big successes with Baffin Bay, and I think we're going to see more coming down the line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
Okay, well, do you want to switch to the Baffin Bay part of it?
Sure.
Or do you have anything to add?
No, that'd be fine. Yeah.
Okay. Well, can you tell me how your work in Baffin Bay started?
Yeah, it was, I got a call from Jace Tunnel, who at that time was at the Coastal Bend Bays and Estuaries program. And he, you know, he told me that he's been communicating with a bunch of folks from down around Baffin who are coming to him with a lot of concerns about the health of the bay. So we convened a little group and started looking at some of the issues, and I think we realized that there was, you know, probably issues with water quality, but we didn't have great data to be sure. So then we went down and met with, at Scott Murray's house, we met with about 40 of his friends and neighbors and folks who shared a lot of great anecdotal information about changes in the bay. And what we ended up doing is, you know, we took a couple of different routes. We developed the Baffin Bay Volunteer Water Quality Monitoring Program to try and get more water quality data. And then Jenny Pollock and Greg Stuns started working on some fisheries issues down there and trying to figure out what was going on with black drum in particular. So we took a couple of different paths and just started trying to get data that we needed.
Mm-hmm. And what did you need? What sort of data did you need?
Yeah, so the state has a water quality sampling program, and I mentioned earlier it's great in that it's been going on for a long time, but they're kind of missing some components that I think we needed to really figure out what the issues were down there. And it's kind of limited in the sense that they only go out every 4 months. They're just resource limited, and they only have two stations in the bay. So what we did is, you know, we got the volunteers to help us really expand that monitoring network in the bay so we could cover all of the arms of the bay where the creeks come in, and then we could really start to figure out, okay, where and when are the water quality conditions less than optimal.
Mm-hmm. So. And what was going on in Baffin Bay that concerned Scott Murray and those folks?
Several things. So they were having some pretty big fish kills. So at that time, I think they'd had probably 4 or 5 major fish kills just over the past 5 years. And this is, you know, trophy trout and drum. They'd also had the persistent brown tide algal bloom. And also the black drum that they were catching, something like 75% of the adult drum had this jelly flesh. Like, you basically couldn't sell them or eat them or anything. They just had no muscle on their body. It was really weird. So just kind of all these things coming together to say something's off with this bay.
Yeah. So why did you want to include these citizen scientists in the monitoring work?
Yeah. Well, we wanted to get started quickly. There wasn't a lot of funding. So, you know, they offered to provide us their boats. They took us out every month. We were able to get started and get data quickly, relatively inexpensively. But on top of that, you know, they just had a lot of great knowledge about the bay and gave us some ideas on where to sample. And we also knew that if there were issues that we were going to need, you know, this group of individuals to kind of help shepherd us and push us towards solutions. So that, you know, that there are a lot of advantages of working with the volunteers.
Yeah. And was it an easy sell to get them involved?
You'll have to ask Scott. They were pretty eager when they came here in May, I think it was. No, I think we started training them in April. They came up here and we brought them into the lab and trained them on how to use some of the equipment. And they seemed pretty eager. It was a great group to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What sort of training did they receive?
They learned how to use our handheld, it's called a sonde. It's an instrument that you drop in the water and it measures the temperature, the salinity, dissolved oxygen. And so they learned how to do that. And then we also showed them the proper ways to collect the water samples so we could be confident in the data we were getting back.
Mm-hmm.
And then just more basic stuff, just like how to record your field observations, things you were seeing out there, and any kind of notes that needed to be taken.
Mm-hmm. So they just went out every month, and then you collected the samples from them. How did that work?
Yeah, we usually sent one person out with each boat just to make sure if there are questions or things. And so what they would do is they would collect the water. They would go out about 7 in the morning usually and go collect the water and bring it back to shore. And then one group would leave usually out of Bird Island Basin, and they would collect samples on the east side of Baffin Bay. And then they would go back, and those samples would come back to the lab where we would process them. And then there was another group that would leave out of Hubert Coffer Park, and they would bring the samples back to Scott Murray's house, and we would process samples under his little garage there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So,
what processing took place with each of these samples?
Oh, you'd have to take water and put it in different bottles. Some of the water had to be filtered, so we would set up little filtration apparatuses, and you know, the volunteers would have their little graduated cylinders, and they'd be measuring water out and doing all kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What were you looking for?
We were trying to figure out, you know, what the levels of different nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus were, how it changed over time, how it varied with natural conditions, and then also how the algae responded to those nutrients. And so we were just really trying to find out, okay, is there a problem with nutrients in this bay? Because a lot of the symptoms seemed to point in that direction, but we didn't have great data to suggest that. And the other thing was, you know, there was a lot of early work done on brown tide that essentially concluded that it was just this sort of natural phenomenon, seemed to not indicate that there are any nutrient problems. But then when you look at that, at those older studies, you realize that they were missing a huge pool of the nitrogen that's in the water. They just didn't measure it because it was kind of hard to measure at that time. But, you know, so that kind of left us with this perception over 10, 15 years that there was nothing wrong with the bay. And so what we did is we tried to get a more comprehensive look at the, you know, the nutrients in the bay. And sure enough, what we found is that the levels of nitrogen in this bay, and in particular a certain type of nitrogen, is on the order of 2 to 3 times higher than anywhere else on the Texas coast, and about as high as you would measure in just about any other bay system in the U.S. So, you know, our data really showed that we've got some nutrient problems in this bay.
Mm-hmm. Can we go back a little bit? Can you tell me why the nitrogen was hard to measure in these earlier studies?
Yeah, I think that at the time those studies were done, there really wasn't great recognition that that type of nitrogen could really even play a role in the environment. And then what we learned since then is that type of nitrogen is actually able to be used by certain types of algae, and it's usually the algae that are not good for the ecosystem. So, you know, on top of not really just recognizing that that type of nitrogen can be important, the analytical techniques were a little bit rough for measuring it.
And can you tell me more about what brown tide actually is?
Yeah, it's just a really small type of plankton. It's about 3 microns in size. I can't give you a good analogy for what that is, but it's really small. Okay. Basically, it's like a very small, nondescript little ball. And, you know, there's all kinds of plankton. There's really charismatic ones that have all kinds of spines and things, and brown tide is really not. It's just this little ball. And it seems to be well adapted for environments like Baffin Bay that occasionally get really salty. And one of the things that it does is it produces this sort of nasty mucus layer around itself to kind of protect it itself. And so that's why there's this perception that it maybe isn't great for food webs either. Like, who wants to eat that, you know? But it is capable of using that form of nitrogen that that we found to be really in high levels in Baffin Bay.
Mm-hmm. And when it's in the water and blooming, I mean, what does it look like? What does it smell like?
It basically makes the water look like chocolate milk. And I mean, you know, we've all kind of been out here in the bays where it can be turbid at times, but just imagine, you know, persistent water looking like chocolate milk for months at a time. And the problem is it prevents the light from getting to the seagrass beds, and so they die off, and then it causes all kinds of other cascading effects. Mm-hmm. So that's basically what happens.
Can you tell me more about the effects it has on the ecosystem?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the main thing are the loss of the seagrass beds. And then, of course, when the seagrass die, that releases even more nutrients back into the water. So that's that cascading effect. There have also been some studies saying that the brown tide is not a great food resource for other plankton, which suggests that, you know, there may be impacts further up the food chain at some point. We don't fully know, but I mean, it's not a hard leap to go from, you know, this nasty little mucus ball to thinking, okay, it's probably not great for other things that need to eat.
Mm-hmm. So when you started taking these samples, what are some of the things you discovered about Baffin Bay?
I think the main thing was that, you know, that we have these really high levels of nutrients. And then we started looking back at some of the historical TCEQ data and realizing that, yeah, there at some point had been an increase in just overall nitrogen in the system. And our data gave us a better idea of what types of nitrogen had really been involved there. We also learned a lot about how drought and wet cycles affect the system and how it works. The other important study that was done was a study by Mark Bezanin, who's a scientist here, where they took sediment cores. So they tried to get an even longer-term record of changes in the bay. And I think what was important about their study is that, you know, they showed that the levels of algae, somewhere back in the 1850s, 1860s, you start to see a gradual increase as, you know, we start clearing the watershed and building farms and things. So you see that gradual increase. Somewhere in the, I don't know, it was hard to say for sure, but probably the 60s, the 70s, it was almost like a sharp exponential increase. And so definitely that also highlighted that, yes, this bay has been undergoing changes for a long time. There's also natural variability. But in recent decades, something has changed to where the system is definitely exhibiting problems with nutrients,
mm-hmm,
and algae.
You know, it seemed like in your one article that was like, I think 2016 or 17, that there were a lot of questions that remained unanswered.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the big questions that we'd had is, where are the nutrients coming from? And we've had some studies funded since then that have really helped us to start to pinpoint where they're coming from. So, for example, when I first started, there was this perception that it was the agricultural producers that were really responsible through their putting fields into production and fertilizer runoff and that kind of stuff. And I think what the data has shown since then is that, you know, the nutrients that go into Baffin Bay, it's coming from a lot of different places. I'm sure there's some agricultural component there. That's hard to deny. But we also have major problems with sewage treatment in that watershed. There are some of the sewage treatment plants that are, they're not up to code. I mean, instances of raw sewage being dumped into the creeks, you can imagine. It's not great. And it is what it is. It's a rural, poor watershed. It's hard for some of the communities to maintain their infrastructure and to hire people to maintain it. So we have issues with wastewater. We have issues with septic tanks that are discharging, not doing a great job of treating the water and putting stuff into the bay. It's a combination of things that are contributing to the changes in the bay.
What do you think is needed to address these problems?
Well, I mean, I think we're starting to get there in that we formed a stakeholder group, and really the first thing is to talk about it. And so we've got this group, about 150 people, you know, agencies, landowners, businesses, you name it, that have been getting together and talking about these issues, looking at the data, trying to figure out what to do next. Our partners at the Texas Water Resources Institute are completing what's called a watershed protection plan, which is basically a menu of things that landowners and municipalities can do to reduce their impact on water quality. And that's going to be a big deal because that's going to open up new funding for fixing some of the problems. But at the same time, you know, there are projects that we're trying to get funded now, sort of larger scale restoration projects through programs like the RESTORE program or the Natural Resources Damage Assessment Program, trying to get these larger scale projects in place to minimize impacts on water quality and improve the quality of the water going into the bay.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me go back a little bit. What were the reactions from those citizen scientists to your work and to your studies?
They were always very positive. I mean, they seemed to enjoy it. I really enjoyed seeing them kind of come together. It seemed to, you know, real camaraderie forming there. I will say after about 4 years, they kind of were like, okay, what's next? You know, we have the data now. What are we going to do? And so that's what we've been working hard since then is getting the solutions in place to fix the problem. You know, that they obviously volunteered for a reason. They want to see the bay fixed and preserved for future generations. So that's what we're working hard to do now.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me more about the benefits of doing citizen science?
Oh, yeah. That's a great question. You get to meet new people. From a practical standpoint, we're able to get more data more frequently than I could ever imagine just by us doing it on our own. But we are also, you know, by working with these folks, you know, they have so many ties in this community and in Baffin Bay in general that it gave us this natural stakeholder base as we made that transition from getting the data to trying to find solutions. We had this sort of built-in network of people who could help us start to expand our network and reach the right individuals.
Mm-hmm. And that's where the stakeholder group mm-hmm. was formed.
That's right.
After the studies were conducted.
Yeah.
Okay. Are there any drawbacks to doing citizen science?
Ooh, I haven't found any. You know, in other places, they sometimes run into issues with data quality. But in our case, you know, we put them through pretty rigorous training. And, of course, we always had somebody out there as well. So I always felt really good about the data we were getting. So I did not find any drawbacks, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What did you hope that the citizen scientists would get out of the project?
Well, I really hope that they would learn more about the bay and maybe challenge some of their own perceptions about what's going on in the bay and how it works. And I think that's the case. I mean, I've definitely noticed, you know, from when we started to where we are now, that how they talk about the bay and, you know, what they think is happening and then also what they want to see, I think it's changed quite a bit.
Yeah.
So I think they've learned something, as I've learned, you know, a lot as well.
Yeah. What would you say your most memorable experience working in this project was?
Oh, that's a hard one. There's so many things. I can't point to one. Just the times that I went out with them on the water and hearing their stories, that's always been a real fun part of it. Hearing the stories and also hearing what their desires are for the bay and just... you know, what they want to see happen. There's so many of them, I'm sure you'll talk to them, that, you just talk about wanting future generations to be able to enjoy what they've enjoyed. And I just thought that's really special. I mean, that's and they're willing to put the time into, you know, making that happen.
Mm-hmm. So. You know, I know one of our questions to ask them is, you know, what does Baffin Bay mean to you? But I wanted to ask you that as well.
Oh, Baffin Bay has been just such an important component of my career. I mean, I spent the last 9 years working on Baffin Bay. It's really become a focal point of my career. So, you know, I owe a lot to the folks down there, and it's been a real honor just getting to work on this challenge. It's also just been very rewarding intellectually. I mean, we started off really not knowing anything, and I've learned a lot about it. So now, for example, we're putting together a special issue of a journal looking at similar systems. So working with colleagues in South Africa and the French Mediterranean and Australia. So trying to, you know, look more broadly at these types of systems that are in these more arid and semi-arid regions and some of the challenges that they're facing. And so I think, you know, Baffin Bay's getting out there, you know, on the world stage too.
So. And can you tell me more about, I don't know how to word this, why it's important for people to know about Baffin Bay outside of, you know, this area?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think, you know, thinking very big picture, you know, the arid and the semi-arid regions around the world are kind of on the front lines of climate changes. And so, you know, a lot of the climate models suggest that we may see expansion of these zones of you know, low rainfall. And so from our perspective, we're kind of wondering, okay, is Baffin Bay kind of an example of what, you know, Corpus Christi Bay or Copano Bay might look like in 100 years or something like that, you know? Just because it does just get that intermittent rainfall. Otherwise, it's pretty dry. So I think one of the things we've learned is that systems in those, that these ecosystems in those areas, just because they don't get a lot of rainfall, they don't get a lot of flushing, they're just very sensitive to pollution, poor water quality. You know, unlike the, I'm trying to think, some of the estuaries in the northeast of the U.S. where you get a lot of rainfall, a lot of river flowing through it, they're always flushed, they don't have the problems that we do. These types of estuaries are very sensitive to changes. Mm-hmm. That answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
What do you think is needed for the future in Baffin Bay? You kind of covered this a little bit, but
yeah, I think anything we can do to increase its resilience. And what I mean by that is, so we have the nutrient problems now, but in the future, Baffin Bay is, and this whole region is going to be experiencing other challenges. In particular, you know, increasing air temperature and water temperature. What that means is that as the water temperature and the air temperature warm, the amount of oxygen that the water can hold, it goes down. And then it also means that you're probably going to see changes in rainfall. So as we move forward, Baffin and the Upper Laguna Madre, it is likely to become an even harsher environment just because of those large scale changes. So that's why it's important that we now get a handle on the pollution that's going into the bay so we can make it as ready as possible for these other changes that are coming down the line.
I think that covered a lot of what I wanted to talk about. What did I miss?
Nothing comes to mind.
Okay. Did you want to?
I think you run me out. I'm pretty good.
Okay. Do you want to add anything else?
No, I'm really appreciative of you doing this, though. This has been, you know, seeing the passion of these folks and. Like I've always just wanted to try and do right by them, and I love their stories, so I'm just excited about this and being able to, you know, capture it, because I think what they're doing is really special, and it, you know, they're a role model to me, but I think they could be a role model to a lot of Texans and beyond Texas, just by virtue of them, you know, being willing to put their time and efforts towards solving these issues. That's really amazing.
Well, that's a great place then. So I'm going to turn off the recorder.
Okay.
Thank you.